As an experienced forester and biologist, Megan Hanacek's colleagues thought she'd make the perfect candidate for the History Channel's TV series Alone. After all, the first two seasons of the reality survival show had been filmed on Megan's home turf, Vancouver Island, where she'd spent countless hours in the bush. Megan made the season 3 final cut and became one of 10 candidates vying to survive the longest, completely alone and with minimal survival equipment. But it wasn't on Vancouver Island. Megan was sent to survive in the wilderness of Argentina's Patagonia region.
Right off the bat, when you land on the beach, you get dropped off. There's, you know, you can easily become overcome by fear. And I, right off the bat, that is like a number one survival skill, is to try to keep your fear in check. And so you just look around at things that are familiar with you. Like if you can recognize tree species, you're like, oh, I know what that tree species is. I don't know what that one is, but I'm getting some comfort in this land. So, you know, I did have a baseline of comfort.
Megan survived alone for 78 days, at times living on as little as 200 calories a day, before fear of a jaw infection forced her to end the journey. Megan says not being able to contact or tell her family and friends where she was during that time was a real challenge.
That I found was one of the most difficult things. At the time, my son was 6 and my daughter was 9. And, you know, we had signed this contract that had huge monetary repercussions if people found out what was going on. So like 6 figures. So we made the decision just to tell my kids that I was on doing field work. And but it's a hard thing not to talk to your child. That was the most difficult thing for me. I had to really, really bury that.
Megan finished season 3 in 3rd place, also making her the 3rd longest lasting contestant in the show's history. And she tells Run It Like a Girl host Bonnie Moak that controlling her fear and keeping her emotions in check were key.
If you need to, like I did cry. I don't cry a lot in my regular life. A lot of my girlfriends had never seen me cry until they saw me on TV crying. But I think it's important to, you know, recognize the emotions that you're feeling in the moment and how you want to express those, and then just move, to always keep moving, and which is a hard thing to do when you're really lacking calories and energy.
Megan Hanacek on this episode of Run It Like a Girl.
So here we are again in our remote studio, where I'm really excited to be talking with Megan Hanacek, who is a forester and a biologist, and also survived 78 days alone on History Channel's television series Alone. Megan, all the way from the West Coast, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our discussion today.
Oh, so am I. I've been waiting for this ever since we first got in contact with each other a little while ago. So I think we should start. You know, it's interesting to me because you're a forester, and that is, I would imagine, a predominantly male occupation. Definitely when you started out. Probably still now.
It very much so it still is, yes.
Okay, great. So let's talk a little bit about your background. And I'm just curious, like, why forestry? How did you end up being a biologist?
Yeah, okay. So this is an interesting one. So I grew up in a small town on the west coast of Canada on Vancouver Island, and my dad was a biology teacher. And when I first went off to university, I actually went off to do pre-med. So I did pre-med for 3 years and did all the biology courses, and then realized, oh, I don't know. I really want to be inside. I had done a couple of lab jobs leading up to, you know, this is what it would be like working in the hospital, be inside for the majority of your time. And then I changed my degree and I finished with an ecology degree. So then I graduated and I did that for a few years, but I did a lot of, during that time, it wasn't really a great hiring environment for biologists in Canada. It was, you know, you could move into the States, you'd have better chance of working outdoors and doing a lot of work outside. But in Canada, it was a lot of database work and inside work. So I did that for a couple of years and I kind of felt like I was on the same track as the jobs I'd done previously. And I'd grown up in a town that was heavily dependent on forestry. And I thought, you know what, maybe I should look at forestry. It never really crossed my mind, but I went back to school and got my registered professional forestry designation. And it's, you know, I've been on this track since, sort of amalgamating land use planning with biology and forestry.
That's super cool. And I want to ask you, so you said your dad was a biology teacher. Did that change the kind of conversations you were having around the table when you went to?
Yes. It's interesting because direct family, we have, even to this day, we have very interesting discussions around land use planning and values and relationships. And I always encourage when I talk to students at universities or even younger students to go into this field, because I don't think we do a really good job of actually explaining what we do in this field. And we're trying to close that gap in terms of education, but it's not as polarized as you either just do conservation or you are on the other side of the table and you're doing harvesting of trees. There's a lot of discussions in between around values and different relationships and how to prioritize things in different regions of Canada. So my dad being a biologist it's interesting because after I got my forestry, it gave me a lot more insight into the complexity of a lot of these land use decisions. So even to this day, we have really interesting discussions and some mining, and his family is in is a longstanding tourism operator in British Columbia. So, and we live in a regional district that is more than 50% First Nations. So, there's a lot of different discussions that, you know, it's a really dynamic, interesting field that requires a lot of skill sets in terms of empathy, just trying to get an understanding of where other parties and stakeholders are coming from, and just balancing values on the landscape. So I love my job. I consider myself very lucky that just by chance, I got into this career fairly early in my life, and I've been able to continue it for a couple of decades now.
So I would like to talk for a second, because you said, you know, maybe not everybody has a clear understanding of what your job actually is. And I'm guessing there might not even be a typical day for you. It might be very different. But what would you be up to Monday, for instance?
My current job is a little bit different. I deal a lot with members and stakeholders. So I'm inside quite a bit nowadays compared to my past 25 years. I was in the bush a lot. I estimate about 2,000 full-on field days in the bush, which is a lot of work in BC, and it's hard on your body as well. But at the same time, you build a lot of skill sets and resilience doing those really hard bush days. So a typical day, that's what I love about it. It's so dynamic. It's always changing. You meet so many different people. Sometimes people are really struggling with really complex issues, and it's really interesting to try to continue to build on your skill set to change things and to really come up for solutions for different complex problems. We live in British Columbia is one of the most biodiverse areas of North America. We have a lot of complex issues. We have a lot of unceded First Nation territories in BC, which is quite unique compared to the rest of North America as well. And we just have a diversity in stakeholders. And I was lucky enough that I happened to work in some of the land use planning for the Great Bear Rainforest. So it just gives you an understanding of different sort of higher level land use planning in different parts of BC. So it's always different and changing. And yeah, there's a lot I could get into in terms of details. But
I bet. So let's then talk about being a woman in a field that's largely dominated by men. What was that like when you were starting out? What changes have you seen? And where is it now compared to when you started?
Yeah, it was, you know, one thing that was, I think my background kind of led me into a field that I didn't quite understand in how complicated and complex was going to be over my two decades of working in it. And I've been lucky enough to work with some amazing males that have really empowered me. I've had some situations that I completely don't want my daughter to ever go through as well. Things have really come around though. I think, you know, in terms of workplace environment, we've had situations though where we've been like, you know, three females in a logging camp and there's 90 males that are fallers, loggers, harvesters, and they didn't really know what to do with us. So they've put us into a trailer that was like infested with mice and like naughty stories. And it's like, come on, like we're all adults here. We've previously stayed in the bunkhouse. We know how to deal with these situations. But I think my background is a little bit interesting because I came, my dad was a single parent and I lived with my dad and brother growing up. So I think it was just, you know, second nature for me to just hang out with men and just sort of not think of it as being anything really unusual. And I think it also gave me a little insight into how men think as well. And I gained some skills through that as well. And that being said, though, I think the environment is continuing to evolve. In British Columbia, you know, we still have about 83% of the forest professionals. There's 5,300, 83% of them are still male. So that there's quite a, you know, it's not a completely half and half split between male and female.
And with the other women who are foresters, is there associations for women to get involved? Is there a push to try to get more women into your field?
Yeah, there is actually, there's a great initiative right now that's going on nationally, and it's around gender equality within this industry. So that's great. That initiative is definitely needed to look at maybe where the gaps are and how you can close some of those gaps. And on a smaller level, the one thing I really, really love my colleagues that are the males as well, but also the females in forestry, usually, you know, we're used to dealing with a lot of diverse logistical issues and problems. So there's not really a lot of time for, I'll just say BS for women to get caught up in drama. So usually it's very supportive, like in terms of the women, we often meet for lunches and we're really supportive of each other.
Well, that's great. And I think women have to be, right? Because you see sometimes that it becomes more of a competition and nobody really gets anywhere that way. So he for she, we for she, women for women, I think that's all very important in any industry, regardless of if it's dominated by men or if it's an even split.
Yeah, for sure.
So I really am excited about talking about this next topic, which is the History Channel's Alone. And it's so funny because, and I just mentioned this to you before, that right before we connected, my friend and I were talking about that show, and she's thinks it's the most amazing show ever, and now she's got us on it. But I would love to talk about Alone. You survived 78 days in the wild as part of season 3, which is the third longest survivor in all seasons of the show.
Yeah.
What made you decide to go on the show? How did that come to be?
Well, it's funny because the first two seasons were filmed in British Columbia. And during the airing of season 1 on TV, I had other colleagues who lived away from my town, but they had sent me links to the show and said, you should really watch this. This is really interesting. And it's in coastal British Columbia. And I watched it. I was like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. Like people are just dropped in the middle of nowhere. And there's, you know, we work in these environments that have a lot of predators with black bears and cougars. And so it was a very unique concept. And then as the year went on, as the show went on, those same colleagues and other colleagues said, you should really apply for this. They knew I had a lot of field experience. They're like, you should try this. And at that point, they had filmed this season, the number one, and then number two, they had also filmed in British Columbia. And, you know, so eventually I talked to my husband. I said, maybe I'll just throw my name in and we'll just see what comes of it. And the next day I got a phone call and they said, can you put together a video series of kind of what you know in bushcraft? And I'm not really a huge bushcraft person, but I know how to be safe in the woods. I know my plants. You know, I do know a lot of skills from over 20 years of working in the bush. So I quickly put together a video and they said, we're really interested in getting you in. But, you know, our season that we're looking at for season 3 is already filled. We already have the candidates that we're looking at. So would you be interested in doing a season 4 that's going to be a couples one? And even before talking to my husband, I said, no, that's not going to work. Like we have children and it's either one of us goes, and my husband has no interest in doing this at all. So they actually fit me into the casting for season 3 as a potential. And within like a couple of weeks, I was in New York and we did a whole series of skill assessments in New York over the week. And there are some amazing candidates, like candidates, the ingenuity around some of their trap systems on catching animals. That was definitely a weakness of mine. I've improved it since then. And leading up to the show, I really worked on that skill. But I came back from New York and the first thing I said to my husband when I walked in the door was, I'm not going to make it. You should see the candidates that are on this. And but I got a call within a week and they said, oh, the other thing about New York, too, is when we were looking through the potential contract before they had picked everyone, we're flipping through and we're like, what the heck? Patagonia? Like, we were going to Patagonia. We just assumed it was going to be in British Columbia again. Yeah. So anyways, when I got back home within the week, I got a phone call and saying, if you want to go, that spot's open, but you have to leave in 3 weeks, which was crazy. Like, that was probably the most stressful of everything. Like, just trying to tie up my job, not tell my employer where I was going, like just ask them if I could have some time off. And they were fully supportive, which I totally really appreciate. I think that's one thing that, you know, in this field really helps, is having that safety net support system. It's, you know, I would not be at my position in my career if I didn't have that leading up to this. So anyways, sure enough, my husband's support and my family behind me, I ended up leaving in 3 weeks. It was just so whirlwind. It was bizarre.
that is crazy. 3 weeks. It's funny because my follow-up question was going to be, how did you prepare? What did you do? But like, so you had 3 weeks. I mean, that's nothing.
I worked until the Friday before I left. I left on a Saturday. I worked until that Friday. And I, you know, in 3 weeks, living in a fairly remote town in British Columbia, it's quite difficult to get really good gear. I had done one trip into one of our biggest two cities, Victoria and Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And even in Victoria and Vancouver, there isn't a lot of the gear that you need, like big ferro rods. We don't have that. Those are kind of things that you get from bigger centers. So when I showed up down in Patagonia, I had this tiny little ferro rod to make my fires. It was like an inch and a half long. One of the other candidates had one that was a foot long and probably weighed 2 pounds. And you could get 10,000 fires out of that. Mine, I could maybe get a couple hundred. So, you know, that was sort of the growing pains of the show too. They hadn't really standardized of the 10 items that you can bring. They hadn't really put tight specifications on what you could bring and what size it could be. So there was a bit of a diversity in amongst the different candidates on the show.
So is it that they provide you with a bigger list and you pick 10 of those things from?
That's correct. There's a list of 40 and you pick 10 items to take with you to survive for as long as you can without any support. You don't get any extra food from them. You have to trap your animals, you have to purify your water without a water purifier. So you're always boiling water, which also requires you to start a fire without having a lighter. You need to have dry tinder. And most of the time our area is wet or either had snow. So just keeping your tinder dry, even if you dry it out and have dry tinder like stored away, you have to continually redry it because of the humidity in the air. Wow. So it's an ongoing, it was hard work the whole time you're out there. They don't necessarily show it all on the show, but it's always going from, you know, from dusk to dawn.
So how did you keep your spirits up or your motivation up while you were there? I mean, 78 days, that's an incredibly long time. What was it like to be by yourself for so long and having to survive?
Yeah, well, for me, having been in this profession as a forester and biologist, being in the woods and being in nature, I find very grounding for me. So right off the bat, even though it was a foreign land, I really found comfort in being in that surrounding. And part of that, too, is like, you know, right off the bat, when you land on the beach, you get dropped off. There's, you know, you can easily become overcome by fear. And right off the bat, that is like a number one survival skill, is to try to keep your fear in check. And so you just look around at things that are familiar with you. Like if you can recognize tree species, you're like, oh, I know what that tree species is. I don't know what that one is, but I'm getting some comfort in this land. So, you know, I did have a baseline of comfort. The hardest thing for me definitely was being away from my husband and children. That was a test of endurance for me. It was very, very difficult. But the one thing that did give me comfort is my husband is just such an involved father. We have extended family. So I knew that they would be fine. But it is a real play on just your connections, your intimate connections that you have in real life, and just not knowing how long. You don't have a set time. Like, you don't have like, oh, I have 2 weeks. I'm just going to keep that in mind. It's 2 weeks. You just don't know how long it's going to be. And when maybe your own human nature finally says enough is enough, I'm done.
Yeah.
So Yeah, it was a test to bring it to as long as I did. 78 days is a long time.
Well, and also, so, you know, for those that might not watch the show, check it out. So you're alone for 78 days, but you don't know if anyone else has quit. So is that,
That's right.
So you're just trying to outlast, but you don't know what you're outlasting. They, like, you don't know if you've made it long enough. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. And you know what, before we launched, so there's 10 of us down. They actually had a couple of alternates in case some last minute things happened. So there was actually 12 of us potential candidates before launch. Some people got into a real guessing game with their mind, like, oh, that person has another 50 pounds. I'm going to kind of keep that in mind. And you can really start playing games with your mind if you start to try to think about the other candidates. So you have to really center on just focusing on yourself and not trying to focus on, I wonder if there's three people left, or I wonder who they are, and I wonder what they're doing. And so, yeah, that's correct. And the other thing too, is I don't think this was mentioned, but there is also the goal of, if you come out is in number one, you get $500,000. So that is and from season one, they actually, before they added that in season one at the very last minute. They actually didn't have a monetary prize, but they added it at the very last minute. And to be honest, that definitely is something that keeps some people going. But if you only go in it for the money, you won't last very long. It's just such a deep experience that after a while, the money, because of what it does to your own body, what it does to your own spirit, just the mind games that you start to play with yourself if you get into that conundrum of, like, the value system of, is this money experience worth the time I'm missing with my children? Mm-hmm. So you can't, to just focus on the money alone, it's kind of taking down a rabbit hole that you don't want to go into.
Yeah, no, I would imagine. I can see how, if money is your end purpose of something like that, you're probably not as well suited for something like that as someone who is just ingrained in knowing how to survive and knowing how to feed themselves and knowing how to be alone. So on day 78, what happened? Like, what was the premise around you putting your hand out?
On day 78, it wasn't just a quick decision that I made that I was going to check out. Many things happen to your body and to your mind, and there's many things you're reconciling when you're out there for that amount of time. So I had cracked a couple of my teeth. I didn't know it was two teeth. I thought it was just one. We don't have a mirror or anything to look at, but I knew I could feel it in my mouth. And progressively over a week, it was getting worse and worse. I had jaw pain. There was swelling in my mouth. So that became a real big turning point for me. All of us that we found out after we had left had lost significant amount of weight. I had actually done the best up until that point out of the top three. I had only lost about 20 pounds. After I checked out, though, I did lose more weight because the refeeding program wasn't really the best refeeding program. They've since learned from that and improved it. But when I had the fear of having a jaw infection and being really rural, and also having my body worn down, that's when the whole thing about money just does not really even factor into the consideration. And the other thing too, I was like coming, it was in August. There was a whole bunch of things. My son was starting a new school. I was progressively getting more and more jaw pain. We don't have any painkillers out there. I ended up having to get two crowns after I left the show. So I had actually not just cracked, but I had broken my molars off from eating rosehip seeds. Inadvertently, they had ended up in my soups. If anyone's ever picked rosehip seeds, they have some of the highest concentrations of vitamin C for fruit in the world. But that also entails having to try to extract really hard seeds that are in the bud, which are about 10 per bud. So I had tried to really pick all the seeds out, but sometimes some of them would end up in the soup. And so I cracked teeth. I don't know when I did it. I think I cracked them before, and then the pain started building over a week. Wow. So that was the main thing. And then it's also like, I don't really have anything else to prove out here. The only thing that would keep me here longer is the money. And at this point, the money actually means nothing to me. And that being said, looking back at it, the man who won our season, The two people on either side of me, number two and number four, were medically extracted. The person who did win our season lost 73 pounds in 86 days. Yeah. So if I had even stayed for, you know, another 9 days, that person still had another 20 pounds to go before they were underweight. So I am completely happy with how it all ended. I am completely happy that I didn't have any accidents and had to leave after 3 days. Completely happy that I had the support system I had and that I've now have this journey inside of me that is unlike anything else in the world.
No, it's incredible and something that'll carry with you for your the rest of your life. And I think
about it every day, buddy. Like when you go into a grocery store, you don't look at grocery stores the same. I would dream about my grocery store, which isn't a huge box grocery store, but I would dream about going through every aisle and like picking out spices or salt or meat or, you know, oatmeal, rice. So I still think about it almost every day when I go through my grocery store. It's there within me. I look at the world in terms of abundance now. I look at potential and opportunity and abundance in so many things now.
Amazing experience for you. And so lucky to have such a great support system, to have a husband that who's home with the children. And
I know. We all joke that. And, you know, because I had signed a really about an 80-page NDA, non-disclosure agreement, and we couldn't tell anyone. So our family didn't know. Like, they just knew I was working. They just assumed I was doing some wildlife work. But you know, we were laughing, my husband and I. I think it would have been more dramatic to actually show him trying to deal with everything at home and people coming up to him and saying, "Where's your wife? Like, I haven't seen her in 2 months." And just, you know, that would have been kind of funny. And then me sitting down in the woods, like by a fire.
Yes.
Yeah.
That would be
very
awesome.
I'm very lucky.
Did your kids know?
No, I found was one of the most difficult things. At the time, my son was 6 and my daughter was 9. And, you know, we had signed this contract that had huge monetary repercussions if people found out what was going on. So like 6 figures. So we made the decision just to tell my kids that I was on doing field work. But it was hard for my husband because my kids would ask and he's so involved that he kept the train going. But, you know, after it becomes like 2 months and the kids are like, where's mom? And I had lined things up for my son's birthday. I'd had a girlfriend of mine with a package that she sent him for his birthday. Oh. But it's a hard thing not to talk to your child. That was the most difficult thing for me. I had to really, really bury that inside me and try not. It would come up sometimes. I would cry, which they caught on TV all the times that because we're filming everything. They caught all of that on TV, which they want to show the human experience out there too, which I appreciate.
So, you know, I want to ask you, because I think, you know, I think something like this experience, but how you do it could probably help many people. Resilience. Resilience must be a huge thing in coping skills while you're away doing this. Yeah. How do you build resilience?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think I had, you know, I had skill sets going into this TV show about trying to ground myself and have the resilience and grit to move through situations. But since the show as well, I think I've really honed in on those skills. And, you know, I think one of the biggest things, and I think this translates into everyday life, is we're constantly messaged through media or just through our relationships or just from being part of a community, which has its benefits. But I think a big thing is keeping fear in check. Like, I think, you know, fear is such a strong emotion. And if you can find skills to keep fear in check and to keep just actively engaging in where you want to go, whether it's in your relationships, your career, getting into those hard places and just, you know, keeping that end goal in sight. Like, fear is a big one. I think if you don't keep your fear in check, you may not even realize it as an individual that you may have fear of, you know, public speaking. And so you just don't attempt to address any of the courses that can maybe help you out. Fear is part of human condition throughout the world. And it's also, I think, empowering if you figure out those skills to keep that fear in check and redirect it.
Well, I liked what you said about, you know, when you were first dropped off, looking for things that were familiar to you to try to help you check that fear. So, I mean, I think that's a great coping skill. and things we need to do. Because, I mean, fear holds people back from so many things, right? That the that people would want to try. So anything that you can do to try to, you know, figure out how to channel your fear or overcome it.
Yeah. And I think as women, you know, this has been said many times over, but we're, there's so much messaging. And I realize this very poignantly now, because I have a 12-year-old daughter, and the messaging that is translated and put on females in our society is quite different than males. And I'm very cognizant of it now in terms of how it influences the psychology. Just even other things that get politicized in our environment, you know, there's things, there are serious things like, say, climate change that we have to take seriously. But it's also like you want to come from a place of strength and empowerment and solutions, not fear. Because once you start acting in that environment of fear, that's when paralysis happens. That's when, you know, people think from a view of scarcity, not in terms of abundance and abundance of solutions. So it's a really big one for me. Like I've really, really honed in on that one over since my experience on Alone. I tried to put my fear in check a lot there. I had fearful moments. We had puma and cougars and lack of food for weeks where I was surviving on 200 calories a day. It was, you know, so there's, when you actually get down to the human necessities and you're dealing with that fear at the human necessity level, it just makes you realize how to approach things differently in your life when you're dealing with maybe not the necessities, but just decision-making in other parts of your life.
So I have I could talk to you for hours, but because I have another question now and I'm going to ask it, but because I think it's also transferable is, so when, well, maybe not, hopefully not the food part, but when you're surviving on 200 calories a day, how do you focus? Like, how do you keep your focus off of how you're feeling to get things done?
Yeah. And that comes back to just really trying to keep emotions in check, like not to, you know, be black and soulless, but just if you need to, like I did cry. I don't cry a lot in my regular life. A lot of my girlfriends had never seen me cry until they saw me on TV crying. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to, you know, recognize the emotions that you're feeling in the moment and how you want to express those. And then just to always keep moving, and which is a hard thing to do when you're really lacking calories and energy. So it could just even be sitting and honing, focusing in on making baskets. I did things like that, or carving, and just really trying to think about how to actively redirect your mind in a positive manner to be productive. And for me, that was making things. They didn't show it a lot, but I had about 200 land traps that I'd set up. I had set up fish traps, which they showed, which were really productive for me. I had made a fishing rod with an actual working reel. I mean, it's in one of the background scenes, but they didn't show that. I made that in the first week, and I just realized, holy smokes, I can't stand here and fish all day. I have to have something that works for me. And I also translate things like that into my regular life. When I look at, you know, using tools like cell phones, like if I get to a point where I find that it's not working for me, that I feel that I'm just, it's using up a lot of my time, and which is taken away from other things that are really important to me, I do a check-in. I do a lot of check-ins in my daily week, what's working, what's not. And I constantly kind of rehone, and use different apps. And like, I'm not a lone survivalist that doesn't use technology. If anything, I'm the opposite. I really try to hone in on things that are really effective and efficient for me.
Cool. That's great. So now I want to ask you, this is a question that we ask all of our guests. And it's kind of the final question of our episode is, if you could go back in time and have lunch with a younger version of you, maybe just starting out in your career, what advice would you say? What would you give? What advice would you give?
Oh, wow. This is a hard one. I would say you have a lot of time. You don't realize how much time, but in 20 years, you're going to see a lot of things in your life. I've gone to all 7 continents in the world, and I've been lucky enough to work through amazing places. Almost on every one of those continents, I've done work. And I would just say, just really appreciate that time and connection you have with people. Because I think nowadays, especially, that pressure is on for us to disengage and just look at our cell phones. And so just really appreciate the relationships and connection. And just also be cognizant of when you're exchanging your time for something, because time is a currency. It's the most important currency. And one thing I realized from being on the Alone show is that within a minute, so much can be accomplished. It's amazing. When you're out there alone, you don't have a lot of things diverting your attention and time. It makes you realize with the right tools and support and abundance around you, 1 minute can be life-changing. Like, it sounds really cliche, but there's so much that can be accomplished in a day if you're thinking from the right mindset and in terms of, in terms of having abundance, not scarcity.
So imagine what you can accomplish in 20 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And just appreciate the journey, much like the Alone show, like, you know, just appreciate the journey because, you know, time is currency and you really need to appreciate that there's so many amazing things around us. And I just find life just to be completely amazing. There's just so many amazing things. And I fill my life with so many interesting, amazing things and interesting people. And so that's where I could go on and on about that question.
So would you go back? Would you do it again?
You know, it's interesting. I was asked to go back for the redemption one, and it was within the year of doing the season that we had done. And it was just, you know, number one, it was too hard for me to think about leaving my children again. That was a very unique experience. Luckily, everything was intact when I got out. There was a few growing pains coming out. It's just such a big event to try to reconcile. You come home with no photos, no video footage. When you watch it on TV, it's the first time with everyone else. So it's a hard thing to try to explain to family, but a big support system is the other candidate, the other contestants who went through it as well. We're all bonded, especially the on our season, the ones that went, five of us went more than 70 days, and three of which were women, which I might add. We're very bonded over the experience. So, you know, I wouldn't say no, but I would definitely think about doing it when my children are not under 18. I would wait until they were older.
Cool. Can't wait for that one. Yeah. So now we call it the Fast Three, and it's just to give our listeners just a bit of insight into kind of what you're interested in. So I'll just ask you three questions and you can give me your answers and that'll be that. So The first question is, what is your favorite source of information or podcast?
Oh, well, you and I connected over your podcast. So I love your podcast.
Awesome.
I love podcasts. Growing up as a child, I read all the time. I would, when our school would have a contest for reading books, I would always be at the top because I love, love, love reading. But as we all know, time's busy and I travel quite a bit. So I love podcasts. So I have so many, quite a few podcasts actually on my phone. And let me just pull that. Let me just see. Just give me 1 second here. Maybe I won't list them all, but I have anything, podcasts that have to do with self-empowerment. So like The Gold Digger, I love ones like that are in the top, you know, or Cutting Edge or Nature Discussions, like In Out is another one. So I love podcasts that are about empowering and talking about human nature. And I also love ones that talk about nature outside.
Very cool. And what are you reading right now?
I have a lot of books. So we moved recently and my husband I think he was just like, oh my gosh, the amount of boxes of books. That's my one thing that I refuse to give up. I'm not a lot into like having a whole closet of clothing that it's my book. So I'm reading also similar to the line of podcasts. I'm reading between nature books and also I love biographies. So some of the ones I'm reading right now are Nature Fix by Florence Williams. The other one is Grit by Angela Duckworth. And then I have Flora and Fauna of Coastal BC in the Pacific Northwest, which is a nature scientific book to explain, you know, different plants and organisms in nature.
And right now, who's currently inspiring you?
You know, I'm inspired at all different levels. Like, I'm inspired. I live in a small town of 2,500 people, and I'm inspired for people that try to help the less fortunate. So we have several volunteers in our town that put on, you know, community meals, or that also mentor students, volunteer their time to help out. So, you know, all the way from our community, all up to the highest level, people that put themselves in hard places, like Romeo Dallaire. I have, you know, tremendous respect for people who've come from really difficult, hard places and have tried to change the world in a positive manner, and to bring people together and to try to find common ground.
Well, Megan, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to sit down and chat with me today. I've loved our conversation. I absolutely think if you ever come to Ottawa, we definitely should go out for a drink.
Oh, we will, for sure.
So just thank you for joining us today for an episode.
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm sure we'll talk for hours when we meet up for that drink in Ottawa.
Sounds perfect.
Run It Like a Girl is hosted by Bonnie Moak. The producer is Brian Long, with technical assistance from Dan Moak, and music by the talented Brooklyn Gillichuk. On the next episode of Run It Like a Girl, Dr. Hedy Fry is the longest-serving female member of parliament in Canadian history, and she defeated a sitting prime minister in 1993 to get there. Of her many leadership roles over the decades, Hedy served in the cabinet of former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien as the Secretary of State for Multiculturalism and the Status of Women. The Honorable Dr. Hedy Fry, on the next episode of Run It Like a Girl.